Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, Japan's nuclear crisis triggers worries in California and a credibility gap for utilities here.
Openness, transparency, and accountability are kind of suspended. Not that we distrust, but that we really want the verification to be there now.
Also, how California growers are scrambling to make sure crops like lemons and strawberries can get safely to Japan. And 4 years after he quit the game, legendary slugger Barry Bonds gets his day in court.
The trial's about Bonds' place in baseball history more than anything else. He's got the biggest record in sports, but what does it mean?
Plus, how a small town placed its hopes on a new state prison after the oil industry dried up. It's the California Report. More than a week after Japan's 9.0 earthquake and tsunami, workers are still desperately trying to get the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant under control. Like any disaster, this one raises the inevitable questions. Could it happen here, and are we prepared? Now, those questions are being directed at operators of California's two nuclear plants, San Onofre in San Clemente and Diablo Canyon in San Luis Obispo. Waves crash against the cliffs of Avila Beach. 85 feet above the ocean sit the two nuclear reactors of Diablo Canyon. Inside the plant are two giant turbines. The turbines help generate the 20% of California's electricity that comes from nuclear power. The plant was controversial from the start. It sits on one earthquake fault, and nearby are three others, including one recently discovered less than a mile offshore. Diablo Canyon has provided electricity to California, safely, for nearly 30 years. But events of the past week have created doubt. Lots of doubt.
We just have more questions now, don't we? We all do.
That's Congresswoman Lois Capps. Her Central Coast district includes Diablo Canyon. This week, she talked by phone with the manager of that nuclear plant, and she had lots of questions.
Where they store their spent fuel rods, how the backup plans, how many there are, how many additional generators they have. These are questions that I asked him.
Diablo Canyon's two nuclear reactors went online in 1985 and 86. And plant spokesman Corey Raftery emphasizes that everything about the plant, design, backup systems, evacuation plans, all anticipate worst-case scenarios.
The safety systems components at the plant all take into account our specific location along the California coast and all of the environmental hazards that could come about in our location.
Diablo Canyon is built to withstand a 7.5 quake, a higher magnitude than seismologists expect from those nearby faults. And the plant sits far above the ocean, making it less susceptible to tsunamis. But none of that satisfies Elizabeth Apfelberg. Her group, Mothers for Peace, has been fighting Diablo Canyon for more than 30 years. And recent events in Japan have reignited old fears and created new ones.
Piping, welds, these corrode over time and are more susceptible to the damage of an earthquake.
This week, a sudden landslide south of Big Sur sent a section of Highway 1 crashing into the ocean. That road, Apfelberg notes, is one of two primary evacuation routes designated by San Luis Obispo County.
If you have a large earthquake, then your evacuation plans that the county thinks are so wonderful may not work.
Like all the nation's nuclear plants, California's come under the watch of the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC. Spokeswoman Lara Uselding.
Weekly inspections. We send out special teams to look deeper into many different areas of the operation. And ongoing test of safety, emergency preparedness, security, all of these areas are being looked at.
This week, the Union of Concerned Scientists released an analysis of the NRC's 2010 safety review of nuclear plants in the U.S. It highlighted 14 so-called near misses the NRC uncovered during inspections, including one at Diablo Canyon. The problem there, malfunctioning valves that went undetected for 18 months in 2008 and 9. The problem could have prevented operators from pumping cool water into the reactor core during an accident. PG&E fixed that problem without incident, but the utility's credibility is in tatters after last year's gas pipeline explosion in San Bruno, south of San Francisco, where 8 people died and dozens of homes were destroyed. That gives ammunition to critics of Diablo Canyon. But Ed Morse, professor of nuclear engineering at UC Berkeley, cautions against drawing too many parallels between Japan and Diablo Canyon.
The plant has extremely rigorous seismic qualification. And by the way, they also have a tsunami-proof set of emergency diesel generators on that site, which is unfortunately something that they didn't have at Daiichi in Japan.
The licenses to operate Diablo Canyon's twin reactors don't expire for 14 or 15 years, but PG&E is already asking to have them extended. This week, Senators Feinstein and Boxer urged the NRC to reevaluate safety at both San Onofre and Diablo Canyon. Local officials are also asking questions. The NRC's Lara Uselding says the crisis in Japan is a learning opportunity for the U.S. nuclear industry.
We're going to be looking at this Japan incident, and we will take any lessons from this. And if we need to do reviews, we will.
As the crisis in Japan deepens, Californians are making a run on potassium iodide pills for protection against radiation that reaches our shores. Amidst panic over that highly unlikely scenario, Penny Borenstein, public health officer for San Luis Obispo County, suggests that instead of stocking up on pills, we do real planning for the eventual big earthquake that's sure to strike California sooner or later.
Have a communication plan, have your 3 days' worth of food and water stored, battery-operated radio, all of those good things.
Of course, planning for the next disaster will have to wait for those still reeling from last week's earthquake and tsunami. In Los Angeles this week, several hundred people came to pay their respects at a memorial and fundraiser in Little Tokyo Thursday night. The Japanese-American Cultural and Community Center held the event, which featured an interfaith prayer service and speeches by local officials. Junichi Ihara is Japan's consul general.
We are not alone. There are people who care about us. This is an encouraging message. And I'm convinced that with the unity of Japanese people, with strong support from all over the world, it may take time, but I'm convinced we can overcome.
About 40 sponsors were on hand to help raise funds for survivors. Gary Glacken is a volunteer with the American Red Cross. He said the most effective way for people to help is with financial assistance.
Physical donations like food or supplies or things like that, they're logistical losses just in moving it from one side of the Pacific to another, and that's even if the infrastructure is there.
The quake and its aftermath are causing economic upheaval on both sides of the Pacific. From cars to printers to alfalfa and microchips, most of the stuff the U.S. buys from Japan or sells to it passes through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. They are the busiest ports in the nation, handling almost $80 billion worth of trade with Japan last year. So, how will they be affected now? That's what we asked the California Report's L.A. Bureau Chief, Chrissy Clark.
And that's what I asked Art Wong, Assistant Director of Communications for the Port of Long Beach. He said it's what he's been asking, too. He tried contacting some of the port's Japanese trade partners to find out.
We've been trying to talk to Toyota, for example, and before we realized how bad it was, we were sending these emails about, okay, well, how's business, what's going on? And you realize the guy can't get out of his house. They're spending half their day and lines getting food and water. And then the more you watch this, the more you realize, oh, my goodness, forget it. The offices are closed. Nobody can get to work. What are we asking?
Wang said there are a few things they do know. It takes 10 to 15 days for ships to get from Japan to L.A., so any trade disruptions won't be felt here until after the weekend. Meanwhile, Wang says ships headed to Asia are still waiting to hear whether Japanese ports are ready to handle them. And then this PR guy, who represents a major hub in the wheel of global commerce, choked up.
These are people that we have worked with for a long time, and you look at the pictures and it's just, you know, are they okay? So it's been pretty scary the first few days.
There are some realms of the economy you'd think have no time for tears. But in a tragedy like this, Wang says, first you make sure everyone's okay. The business will get sorted out later. For the California Report, I'm Chrissy Clark in Los Angeles.
Japan is the third largest importer of California-grown crops, including rice, almonds, wine, beef, lemons, and asparagus. Most of it goes by sea, and produce shippers, like Yuba County's Shoei Foods, are scrambling to keep track of containers that have been rerouted or delayed since the earthquake and tsunami. Shoei buys hundreds of California-grown crops and sends them to Japan. Don Sudert is the company's managing director.
We lost a container of walnuts to the tsunami up in the Sendai area, and we also have a warehouse near there that where we have about $40 million of products in it, so we can't get to those products.
And there are other problems. Rolling blackouts in Japan mean cold storage containers can't necessarily keep produce chilled. More delicate crops like asparagus, cherries, and strawberries are flown to Japan. Carolyn O'Donnell is with the California Strawberry Commission.
What we're hearing is that there is no cargo room available, that a lot of the air freight that's being carried is relief supplies, and there are other things that are taking a front seat to sending fresh produce over right now.
Meanwhile, the Food and Drug Administration says any potential radiation reaching the West Coast is not expected to pose a threat to the safety of California agriculture or people. Well, opening day for Major League Baseball is less than 2 weeks away, and this year it coincides with something the league would just as soon forget: legal issues from the steroid scandal involving home run champ Barry Bonds. The former San Francisco Giants star goes on trial Monday. He's accused of lying under oath to a federal grand jury that was investigating the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative, known as BALCO. That was back in 2003. Journalist Lance Williams with California Watch and the Center for Investigative Reporting has been covering this from the very beginning, and he's with us now. And Lance Williams, first of all, just a very basic question. What exactly is Barry Bonds accused of doing?
He's accused of lying under oath to a grand jury when he was asked if he had used steroids and other banned drugs and if he had ever been injected or injected himself with stuff. Under oath, he denied knowingly using banned drugs. The questioning was in the context of a federal investigation of the BALCO steroid ring. And years after the testimony, the government circled back and indicted him for perjury and obstruction of justice, saying his answers were willfully false and intended to mislead the government.
And how is the government going to prove its case? What evidence does it have that Bonds knowingly lied?
Well, it's a two-part process, as you point out. First, they have to prove that he used steroids. For that, they have some scientific evidence and a long list of witnesses, some with direct knowledge, others who can testify about circumstances. Then the second part is proving that he understood his answers, that he meant them to be false, that he intended to mislead the government. And that's a legal question that ultimately will be left to the jury.
Now, the one person who certainly could or would have direct knowledge of that is Barry Bonds' trainer, Greg Anderson. He's refusing to testify. So who else might have direct knowledge that Barry Bonds used steroids?
Well, the government says that his personal shopper, saw Greg Anderson inject Barry in the stomach. They have a former Giants catcher, Bobby Estalea, who, according to court records, will say that Bonds told him that Bonds was using steroids. A former girlfriend, Kim Bell, who says the same thing. The case is complicated, as you indicated, by the trainer's refusal to testify. From the government's standpoint, the biggest problem that has posed is the judge threw out a whole lot of evidence that Bonds was using banned drugs. Private steroid tests and doping schedules or calendars, all of them maintained by the trainer in folders with Bonds' name or initial on them, that seem to reflect, you know, frequent use of a long list of drugs all during the period when he was setting his home run records. But the judge said without the trainer's testimony, that information is hearsay and is not available for the prosecution. That's a big benefit to Bonds and his defense team.
Well, let me ask you about the jury. Jury selection is going to get underway on Monday. How tough is it going to be to get what you might call an impartial jury from the Bay Area, where obviously everyone knows or most people know Barry Bonds and may or may not be fans of the Giants?
Well, having covered a lot of trials, I'm always surprised at how uninformed a jury panel can be, even in a case that you think everybody knows about. Nevertheless, the Giants just won the World Series, and it would probably be hard to find somebody who's not familiar with who Bonds is, who the Giants are, and what steroids are. The task is to get a jury that'll set aside, you know, their preconceptions or information they've learned in the past. A lot of Giants fans were very forgiving of Bonds or couldn't believe he was a steroid user and just had high regard for him. Other baseball fans are repelled and offended that the home run king is mixed up in steroids.
Barry Bonds hung up his Giants uniform at the end of the 2007 season, I believe it was. And as you point out, the Giants won the World Series last year. And the Bonds steroid scandal in some ways seems like a distant memory. And I'm wondering, how much do you think fans in the Bay Area care about this trial?
Really, the trial's about Bonds' place in baseball history more than anything else. He's got the biggest record in sports. But what does it mean? Bonds hopes he will be vindicated by a not guilty verdict. People who follow the game say that if he were to be acquitted, his chances of going in the Hall of Fame and having his record regarded as legitimate go way up. If he gets convicted, you know, it's probably over in terms of that kind of post-career celebration.
Any chance of him going to jail?
Most experts think not, simply because the judge has declined to sentence other sports figures to prison for lying about steroids. She tried the track coach Graham and put him on house arrest. Technically, you know, the guidelines call for, I think, 2 years in prison for a conviction on this. But it's probably not about jail. It's about reputation.
All right. Lance Williams, co-author of the book Game of Shadows. He's a reporter for California Watch and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Lance, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Today, we continue our series, New Harvest, the future of small-town California, looking at changes in rural parts of the state. In 1929, oil was discovered in the Kettleman Hills, and the nearby town of Avenel was born.
Well, here it is, honey. This will be where we're going to live for a while anyway.
It's beautiful here, darling. I love it.
The movie Boomtown, Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert moved to the area seeking their fortune in oil production.
Yeah, they call it Kettleman Hills.
Kettleman Hills doesn't even sound like oil.
But by the 1960s, the oil business dried up, and Avenel struggled to find a new economy and a new identity. As reporter Lisa Morehouse tells us, they found one in an industry other towns shunned.
The sign at the edge of town says population 15,689. But that number's a little deceiving. More than a third of that population is behind bars. With 6,000 inmates, Avenel State Prison is structured like a town within a town. There's a furniture factory, a metal fabrication shop, and this chicken farm, which supplies 100,000 eggs a day to correctional facilities across the state.
I never would have thought I'd be working in a chicken ranch. And it's I love it now.
You do?
Yeah.
Inmates like Alfonso Martinez earn between 20 and 95 cents an hour here.
The benefit is you get away all day. It's away from the madness in the buildings. I think that's my good benefit for me.
Outside the prison gates, about a quarter of Avenel's population is out of work. The town never really recovered from the oil company's departure, and seasonal farm work jobs here are no match for oil boom wages. So, in the 1980s, when city leaders heard that the state was looking to build more prisons, Avenel became the first California town to solicit a prison. State officials were surprised, says longtime Mayor Harlan Cassada.
Usually they would be met at the city limits with a vigilante crew saying, we don't want a prison. But I think we looked at it differently.
The town saw an opportunity, high-paying permanent jobs for locals and a surge of new residents moving to town and improving Avenel's tax base. It never really happened.
Another empty garage.
Community activist Ray Leon drives through a housing development called the Westview, built in anticipation of correctional officers moving to Avenel. It's run down now, with a lot of vacancies. Leon grew up in Avenel, and as a child, he watched crews building the prison from his family room window.
Essentially what happened is that it became an EDD, economic development dead.
Some local kids have gotten jobs in the prison industry after college, but the latest numbers indicate that fewer than 5% of the prison's employees live in Avenel. Many commute for more than an hour to get here.
It was a very big disappointment.
That's Donna Curdy, a passionate teacher of GED classes at the prison.
We felt that we had a lot to offer. We had good schools at that time, but they never gave us really a chance, you know, to even know us. So it was kind of a hurt all the way around, I think, because it just didn't generate like we thought it would.
Curdy's roots run deep in Avenel. Both of her grandfathers worked the Discovery Well in the oil fields, and she taught public school for decades. One of the prison's earliest boosters, Curdy, now says she'd advise a little caution to other towns.
Well, they'd have to sit down and think about it real, real hard. What did you want from that prison? We're kind of interdependent, really. It's like a mother and a child, I guess.
The town gets about $100 per capita from the state for things like streets and city operations, so prison residents account for about $600,000 a year. And when the prison came in, the state paid for capital costs, like the new water and sewage treatment plants the prison and town share. Mayor Harlan Cassada.
If we had it to do over, I would say, yeah, I'd do it over. It's been that much benefit versus the negative.
If there's a fire in Avenel, the prison fire department and its inmate crew are first responders. An inmate in the metal shop even made the decorative light sconces for the renovated downtown theater. With big prison contracts like food services and construction, the state usually hires companies far from Avenel. But locals say prison staff and visitors help the bottom line of local small businesses.
This is carnitas.
19-year-old Leo Martinez helps his parents run La Nueva Reina, a taqueria and meat market known for its handmade chorizo sausage.
A lot of family members that come and visit our relatives over there in prison, well, they come over here just to eat. Yeah. We have a lot of correctional officers, too.
Avenel invested in a facelift when the prison came in.
When the prison came, they started building curbs and gutters around here.
A group of guys in their 40s are gathered around a truck, getting ready for a family gathering.
It's pretty ugly back in the day without the prison here.
It improved a little bit, but, you know, not much.
But Debbie Reyes of the California Prison Moratorium Project says those little improvements don't outweigh the real costs of prisons. She sees the social impact on children who grow up in a prison shadow.
If I were that child playing football in the field and I'm living with a gun tower overlooking my school,
I think that desensitizes that child from their environment, right? That's a norm.
This is personal work for Reyes. Her brother's locked up in Avenel, and she's a Valley native. This town started a prison boom in the Central Valley, which now houses nearly 20 adult and youth facilities, more than in any other region of the state.
There's Atwater, there's Delano, Owasco, Avenel, Mendota, Mule Creek, Folsom.
Even though some small towns have rejected prison development, the Central Valley's been dubbed Prison Alley.
The communities that are targeted here are Spanish-speaking only, low education, farm working communities.
Communities, she says, which haven't gotten out of poverty with the growing number of prisons. People like Avenel City Councilman Dagoberto Ovalle are looking for solutions. He's helped bring in classes in welding and forklift operations to retrain unemployed residents. And he supported development of this solar farm, which is providing temporary jobs for locals during its construction.
My hope is that it will be like a daisy chain type thing, you know, business-wise. This will bring other things to this area, and that's all we can hope for.
Next to the small highway on the edge of town, only a few cars go by. Organic carrot fields and ranch land run up to the edge of the hills, and Chuy Resendez and his buddies are still hanging around the truck telling stories about growing up in Avenel.
Me and him, we love it. We love this, you know. No traffic, no people. We're like a bunch of hillbillies. We love this stuff.
For them and the others who choose to live here, regardless of its uncertain future, Avenel is still the perfect home.
Deal with the traffic, you know. One car in front of you is, I guess, traffic for them. Well, you got to get down to Modesto, you're sitting.
For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Avenel.
Deborah George was a contributing editor on that story. To see photos of what Avenel looked like as a booming oil town and learn more about the town's solar farm, check out our website, californiareport.org. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. Our interns are Lillian Manjo and Alexandra Wexler. The producer is Victoria Maleon. We had production help from Sarah Bond. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen with help from David Marks. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2011 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health begins. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The SunPower Corporation, online at sunpowersolar.com.